You're listening to the official podcast of Asbury University, produced by students with God-honoring conversations that inform, edify, and encourage. This is Asbury. We explore culture and current topics through a Christian worldview, promoting a well-balanced life, and we empower our community to belong, become, and be set apart. I'm your host, Abby Laub. Welcome to This is Asbury.
Well, welcome to the podcast. We have a guest today, Kevin Ballou. Thank you, Kevin, for being here. Kevin is the Associate Dean of Wholeness and Wellness at Asbury, and you've been here for 12 years, Kevin. So tell us what you've been up to in those 12 years.
Wow. Yeah, 12 years. Sounds like a long time. I've been up to a lot of things. I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor by training, and I was hired on here to do mental health counseling with students. And a few years into that tenure, we did a little combination of our student health services and Center for Counseling. And I sort of became what we call the Associate Dean of Wholeness and Wellness, which oversees sort of the physical health care of our students as well as the mental health care. And we wanted to be collaborative in that kind of fashion to really better address the needs of our students.
Yeah. What does some of that entail? Because I feel like you guys are kind of behind the scenes and, you know, working with students, you know, face to face with counseling and whatnot. But you mentioned wellness and including physical wellness. What does that look like?
So, right. It's a great question. We're our office is really staffed by a team of counselors. Mm-hmm. And we also have three nurses on staff. Mm-hmm. We have a doctor that's part time as well. And so students who are experiencing any kind of an acute medical condition will come and visit if they're sick with the flu or COVID or, I mean, they've strep throat. Then there are ongoing student situations where students need allergy shots or they may have ongoing care. They may have injured themselves and they would come to our office. As well as on the other side of the building, so to speak, we would provide counseling services for students. Mm-hmm. As you might imagine, at a university setting, really the most frequent, most common reason students would seek counseling would be something related with anxiety or stress. Feeling overwhelmed, dealing with social anxiety or generalized anxiety. And then from there, all sorts of things, transitional issues, family of origin issues, mood disorders. And we could go down the list of reasons that students would come to our office. Yeah. Largely space for students to heal.
Yeah, it's great. Well, I know they really like you because I always hear good things. So you mentioned that, you know, therapy is becoming more popular or at least more widely acknowledged as, you know, legitimate, credible, you're not crazy. It's good. You know, these are good things. This is a generalization, but I would venture to guess, you know, like you said, that previous generations, it was like, oh my gosh, you have to go to counseling. Like, you must be really messed up. And now it's like, no, it's good. I'm working through these things and you probably need to too. But, you know, that being said, we've also heard criticisms of, you know, people using the word trauma very lightly. You know, maybe they might even say they have PTSD or something, and it could be related to dinner the night before. You know, this is silly, but there are some really serious medical conditions that we were talking about with these things, and you do find these words used a little more lightly, perhaps. What do you think is perpetuating this, and how does society misuse these words?
This is a great question, super hot topic. I mean, it is interesting. A piece of that, Bessel van der Kolk wrote a book a number of years ago called The Body Keeps a Score. Mm-hmm. It is a great resource and a great book and in terms of mental health and trauma, but it really brought that word into the mainstream more than it had been. And we have seen exactly what you're saying, like in younger generations, trauma refers to everything. A classroom, you know, the professor calling on you in class could be a traumatic experience. Then as trauma entered the mainstream and social media also, it just started getting thrown around away from its clinical use, which then we started separating what we called capital T trauma, which was more of the DSM-5 definition of like really a life or death threatening situation from lowercase t, which is like this is a hard situation or an unpleasant. I've gone because a lot of times clinically, it doesn't matter because it is the perception of like how that affected a person. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I've kind of distanced myself away from that term altogether and just mm-hmm. use adverse life experience.
Yeah,
I mean, a capital T traumatic car accident is an adverse
right.
life experience.
Right.
But also being called out by your coach in front of a team could be an adverse life experience for someone. And truthfully, these experiences are relative. If you're a college student who comes from a really healthy, protected home, and you come to college and you date someone for 2 months, and there's a breakup, that might be the biggest adverse life experience they've experienced thus far. And it could be devastating for an individual, but to someone else who's been through a lot in their family, that might not be a big deal, right? And so it's relative to experience.
So where do you say, you know, when you're working with students, where do you say like, okay, well, this is going to build character, this is going to build strength and fortitude versus, run away from it, you know?
Right. So, I mean, like, isn't
resilience
founded on adverse life experiences?
Right.
I mean, and so... One, we know that's like, I always say that's like one of the least talked about promises that Jesus gave us. You know, they're going to have trouble. In this world, you're going to have trouble. And we don't like to think about that.
Not
but
a popular
it is,
verse.
No, it's not in the little books you get at a bookstore, Christian bookstore. But it is the truth. And that is actually well documented that those experiences are what make us resilient. I don't want to sit back and say, hey, that's a good thing in anyone's life. I do say, I mean, for folks that experience those difficulties, a real sign of healing, whether it's a capital T trauma or lowercase trauma, adverse life experience, is that if someone can come to a place where they say, I would never want that to happen in your life, but I wouldn't take it out of my story.
Right.
That's a sign that they've healed and that they're actually seeing that as a part of making them who they are at this point.
Yeah.
And in that case, it's sort of now a decent thing in their experience,
right.
something that taught them.
But yeah, it took them a little work to get there.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah.
Right.
So you see a lot of students, obviously the majority of these students, we would guess, you know, came from home living with their parents or their, you know, caregiver. So how, and then a lot of parents listen to this podcast. So how would you tell these parents based on, you know, what you've seen, how would you encourage them to help build that resilience in their students when they come to college?
What a great, great question. I would go back to a book I read a number of years ago when I was sort of early into parenting. It was fascinating to me, the idea. The book was called Too Much of a Good Thing. And it really taught me this idea that my job as a parent was not to protect my kid from adversity,
right?
My job as a parent was to help my kid handle adversity.
Yes.
And so when their iPod breaks or their iPhone is shattered, it's not my job to make sure that they don't cry because and go buy them a new one or whatever the next thing is. It's actually to teach them how to handle the hard stuff.
Yeah.
And the hard stuff is going to come. Everybody goes to middle school.
It's
hard. It's going to be relationships are hard. And our job isn't to protect them from ever having difficult experiences. As a matter of fact, if we want to do them justice and help them become adults, it's really walking with them and teaching them what it means to suffer well, what it means to go through hard things and still hold your head up and keep going. So you can take that for however you want to take it.
Oh, that's great. Because you have several kids yourself.
I have a couple.
You've got a couple.
I have six kids.
What are their ages?
23, 21, 21. Almost
twins.
21. She'll be 21.
Okay.
She just turned 21, actually.
So they're not twins.
They're not twins.
Okay.
And I have a 16-year-old. I have a 12-year-old and a 10-year-old.
So you've learned a lot over the years. What are some of your, you know, best parenting tips?
How personal can I get here? I said to my wife recently, I'm 50 now, about to be 51. I said, I wish when we were raising our first two, I wish I had the perspective that I have now as a 50-year-old. Because my youngest is 10, and there's just a lot more that can that just rolls off.
Right.
That I just don't take personally. I'm like, yeah, she's 10. Yeah. That's what happens. When my oldest was coming up, I had this like overactive sense of responsibility and like I had to, you know, make sure that you behave. And if you do that, then like I'm going to be a bad parent. And at this point, I'm pushing like that grandparent place.
Number
where it's
six,
like,
you're like,
they'll
figure
work
it
out.
Yeah.
Right.
They'll
figure it
fine.
Out. That's exactly right.
Well, and I think that that's a healthy perspective to have because you do see a lot of parents really beating themselves up. And like, if I don't get them in every activity, like I have failed, you know, it's just not true. We all know. So you've been a parent for a long time. You've also been a counselor for about 23 years. So can you point to any, you know, harmful methods of therapy? Say there's someone who is looking for a therapist, you know, whether it's for their kid or for themselves after they graduate, you know, can you just give any tips on finding a good one or learning what to avoid?
Wow. Yeah, that's a tough one. One of the biggest challenges in getting effective therapy is finding someone that you can connect with, who you like. This is getting easier, I think. Mm. And so it used to be, hey, Kevin, this is going on in my family. Mm-hmm. Do you have a therapist? Do you know a therapist you can refer me to? And then it would be a whole list of questions. Well, what's your insurance? Or do you have insurance? Do you want a male or female? Is it important that they're a Christian counselor or that they're a Christian or not too much Christian or whatever, all these different options. And now we say telehealth or in person. And there are resources now. Psychology Today has a great resource online that's just find a therapist. And there are lots of other versions of that, but that's probably the most global one where you can go and you can type in your zip code or your city. You can put in all the checklists. Male takes Anthem Blue Cross, once specializes in depression or whatever form, and you'll get then a list of 10 or 12 therapists. Yeah. It'll also tell you their modalities, what they work with, what kind of therapies they do. Mm-hmm. Therapy is like language in a lot of ways. So there are lots of ways to get to healing. And so you could have 50 theoretic orientations in which a clinician might work from. In many ways, each of them can be effective in their own way. There's going to be preferences that clients have in terms of, I really like this kind of therapy and I want to find somebody that does this, or I really like that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to pull back on saying anything that's harmful. Finding a good clinician, and this is actually where things are most harmful, is that if people aren't matched with somebody that they like, appreciate, they have connection with,
just give up altogether.
They just quit. Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Definitely. They're like, nope, see, this isn't worth it. I'm not going to do it. Yeah. And then they don't get help. Or if they need help, they're not getting what they need. So.
Right. Are there ever times where you feel like, okay, maybe you don't need therapy? And let me explain that. I don't mean that. But like sometimes, like, sure, maybe they need therapy. Or maybe they just need to be encouraged to sleep more or eat better or go outside. You know what I mean? Like, does that happen?
It does happen. And I actually asked this question pre-COVID when a student request for counseling was peaking before COVID.
Yeah.
I asked this question, and it was, are we actually being complicit with the mental health crisis by doing therapy?
Right.
And by that, what I meant was, we're allowing people to do what friends, family, pastors, roommates, faculty, and others did in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And there were certainly instances where students were coming over to talk about things that you would have talked with your roommate about before.
Yeah.
And there have been instances where I've said, hey, what you need is a mentor. What you need is a friend. What you need is, you know, a pastor, someone in your life. You don't need therapy.
Yeah.
And I have said that. Now, I would also make some arguments that, I mean, anyone could benefit from therapy. Okay. Anybody could benefit from that. Not everybody needs that.
Right.
And the question to me was, Are we taking away the opportunity for people to have what I would call natural relationships rather than professional relationships? Like, a therapist isn't going to be able to be there at midnight, you know?
Right.
Your graduation. You know, like, we want people to have those supports.
So, Kevin, according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 1 in 5 U.S. adults experience mental illness each year, and less than half of them receive treatment. What do you think this statistic says about society?
one in five mm-hmm. individuals experiencing a mental illness. Mm-hmm. It is a commentary on the society, if you ask me, mm-hmm. and that we need to take a look at yeah. what is happening yeah. in that society. That would be my response mm-hmm. to that. And, I mean, we have lots of evidence that points to specific things that have been happening in mm-hmm. our culture that lead toward the deterioration of mental health. Yeah. And I mean, we could go back in time quite a bit. I mean, we have seen an erosion of family over the mm-hmm. course of years.
Yeah.
We have seen real clear data from 2007 on related to suicidal ideation. 2007 was the year the iPhone came out.
Yeah.
We started to see increases in social media usage, and we watch, particularly young women, the spike in suicidal ideation that's related to that, likely the social comparison
right.
component. How people are getting treatment. You said half of those were mm-hmm. receiving treatment. Mm-hmm. Again, I think if I'm going to speak into this, that saying 20%, that's a large number mm-hmm. of people. And a lot of those people just endure that distress and would go unidentified. Some people don't have access for sure right. to that kind of treatment.
Yeah. So you talk about things like the erosion of family. You know, you could also look at stats that say erosion of faith or erosion of, you know, a church family, all sorts of social structures that typically used to kind of hold people together, you mm-hmm. know, yep. literally and figuratively. And then you couple that with social media use and even just excessive, you know, screen time. There's even, you know, data that says that's just not good for you physically, mentally. You know, this is all just kind of feels like a perfect storm.
Yep.
Do you feel like people are recognizing this at least, and we maybe we're turning the ship a little bit?
There are pockets. There are instances, and I look at our students, and there is more awareness in 2024 than there was in 2015.
Yeah.
And there are more students that say, "I'm leaving my phone. I'm putting it down." Mm. They don't want to bring it to dinner. They want to go away for a weekend, and they're like, "I'm not taking my phone." That's happening more than it did, I would say, 9 years ago.
Yeah.
However, it's just like, I mean, a tsunami of like yeah. everything that young folks are wanting to do is connected to their phone in some capacity. So it's so difficult to yeah. put it down. Like, even to say phones are a great manager of life. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, they manage our schedules and everything else, but they also distract us from anything that's painful.
Yeah, right? Yes.
So, I mean, I say it all the time. We used to stand in line at Kroger, right? And you'd either
really
talk
bored.
To someone, be uncomfortable, or you'd read the tabloid, right? I mean, like, read yeah. the headlines on the tabloid. And now we don't even experience that discomfort. Like, yeah. we pop out our phones and we're scrolling Instagram or Facebook or whatever it is to kind of
comfort
keep
crisis.
Us
yeah.
out of whatever else yeah. might be going on. And that, yeah. that comes at a huge cost. I mean, the more recent data, we've known for a long time that like social comparison, particularly when we're comparing up, made us feel bad, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're like, okay, just this isn't bad. More recently, the data is like, even when we compare down, like we feel better than the other, that makes us feel worse too.
Right.
So no matter how you compare, it's detrimental to your mood.
Yeah.
So these things are dangerous to our mental health in so many ways. And I don't think in 2024 the solution is going to be don't have one.
Right.
I think that we just we need to be smart about how we use it, when we use it, when we introduce mm-hmm. our kids to it and
yeah,
allow
that's,
them. That's really that, important.
From your standpoint, from what you've seen in 23 years of practicing, six kids from us, you know, clinical standpoint, what do you think is the best age for parents to try to introduce phones to their kids? I know that is a hot take.
Right, right. And it always seems like it's changing, too.
Right. And every kid's different. Yes, sure. But
right,
developmentally,
right.
there are some considerations.
Yeah. And I mean, that even your question has a lot of like subtlety to it, because
yeah.
are we introducing like cell phone service or internet? Are they having access to the internet? Are they having access
media?
To what apps?
Yes, yes.
And so, I mean, the most recent trend I watched in fifth grade, when my daughter was in fifth grade, was parents that were getting Apple Watches for their fifth graders so that they could text them and they could text back. But they didn't have internet
a plan.
Full
right.
capabilities.
Right.
I think parents need to know that their kids are curious. Their kids are going to explore whatever they can explore. Mm-hmm. And they're just curious. We're, mm-hmm. That's a human the human need in some capacity. And
well,
so,
and they don't know the dangers until there's something right in their face. And they're like, whoa, what's happening?
So, I mean, I don't want to put a specific age on having a phone. I think parents should limit access. And I would not encourage giving kids access to Google mm-hmm. on their phone that
right.
travels with them.
Right.
I mean, it is absolutely absurd when we think about it, what you can access on the internet, what people will access on the internet. Mm-hmm. And then we give it in a pocket form that can't be really traced or tracked, and it goes everywhere with you. It's a real, I mean, it's just a danger. I mean, when we talk
yeah.
about addiction of any form, we look at sort of accessibility
yeah.
And accountability as measures of how highly addictive something is. And so if you think of the internet and pornography and all kinds of violence and other things that are on there, like accessibility, super easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just keystrokes away, as well as then accountability. You can do it with no accountability. And so, like, this is like a formula for a perfect drug.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, so many things for parents to consider. And I think, obviously, you know, parents just need to be unified in that decision, because kids know. We all know. Kids know how, well, mom told me this. Well, dad told me this, you know.
Yes.
Being unified even, you know, with grandparents or other people who are influencing your kids. And, like, be really clear with them. Like, we don't do this. We do this. So everyone is on the same page.
Right.
So I think one of the biggest issues with phones, or, you know, technology as a whole, I guess we could say, is loneliness. You know, it breeds loneliness just inherently, because it's like you think you're connected. Oh, I'm connected because I can just text this person. It is just not the same. And loneliness is a huge problem. Where is this coming from, and what does it do to a person to be
right.
lonely?
Right. Great question. I mean, it has devastating effects on us. In some recent studies on loneliness in America, a research question was asked, how many confidants do you have?
Mm.
The most common answer the American gave was zero.
Oh, wow.
Zero.
Men,
zero
men
confidants.
Men and
women? So what, yes.
Mm,
okay. And what impact does that have on a person? Think about how, well, think about some other data that actually comes out of the 84-year Harvard study on the good life. Every discipline has gotten their hands on the data that's coming out of that study, and every discipline comes back with the same results. They say mm-hmm. the most important factor to a good life is relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So put those two together. If the most important thing to the good life is healthy relationships, and the average American has zero confidants, we're struggling, right?
Yeah.
So we can be disconnected, but then on top of it, and I think this is a place where technology comes in,
mm.
we can be so entertained, and it distracts us from the loneliness, which is actually trying to bring us back to the relationships,
mm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
feeling lonely, right? I ask students in a theory of wellness class, I'll say, you know, what is lonely? Like, how do you respond when you feel lonely? And I'll get a list of answers. And it's watch Netflix, get on YouTube, listen to podcasts.
Like, no!
And right, those are all distractions
right.
from the feeling. What loneliness is actually saying is, hey, people are important. Go get connected
yeah.
to people. And what we do is often the opposite. We isolate ourselves.
Mm.
And doggone it, the technology is so accessible and it's so entertaining,
mm-hmm.
which is awesome. But we can watch another season of whatever show and in the end feel okay. And then the next morning wake up and we're like, oh, I'm all alone. I don't have anybody.
So your counseling theoretical orientation in closing, Kevin, you mentioned a model of counseling that you've been practicing at Asbury called internal family systems. What is that and how does that work?
Yeah, so this is a relatively new approach to therapy and really understanding the human condition, I would say,
mm-hmm.
in life.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it was established by a guy named Richard Swartz in the 1980s. He was a family therapist, worked systems and paid attention to systems. He actually applied the systems theory then to the individual with an idea that within each of us are different parts or aspects. And so you might recognize this, like, oh, part of me really wants to go out on Friday night, but I'm so exhausted, I just want to crash too. So there's the, like, competing polarized parts, but that all humans have multiplicity of the mind, and we have parts that interact in systems that drive behaviors and get outcomes. Now, what one of the things that's really different about this approach is it's non-pathologizing, and it really recognizes that behaviors, symptoms, diagnoses that, that we would consider from the DSM are quite often parts. They're parts of an individual that make sense in the context in which they were formed. And so it's not that you are an anxiety disorder or, you know, that is who you are or what, or I am depressed. It's that there are parts of you that experience that.
Right.
And these parts then are always really intending good, most a lot of times protection for the individual. Problem is, a lot of these parts, their strategies, they blow up and they backfire and they create problems. And so phones, I mean, substance use, we could go through a list of things. Social anxiety is a great one. I've not worked with a college student with social anxiety that hasn't had an adverse life experience that caused the initiation of social anxiety. And so when they get to college, they want to be safe, right? The competing need, you got two competing needs here, safety and connection. And because they've been hurt somewhere in high school, middle school, wherever, by another human being, by a group of people, whatever it might be, they're focused almost entirely on safety. They'll take their green container to the cafeteria, get their tray, go back to the room and watch YouTube. That's entirely safe. And that's important. That's a human need. However, you play that out for a semester or a year and you can about predict what's going to happen next. That student is going to feel very isolated, very alone, and pretty quickly depressed because another competing universal human need is connection, belonging. And if they're not getting that because their need for safety is so high, they're going to feel that. So they come in saying they're depressed, maybe. And we can trace some of that back with the parts
the,
work.
The patterns that have led to that. We could talk about this all day. Thank you so much for your time. But in closing, last question, you know, it's the end of the summer. Fall semester is about to start back up. How would you encourage students or parents, you know, just to prepare mentally, spiritually, emotionally as they get ready to head to college?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'd say a couple things. One, the first thing that popped into my mind was, like, encourage your student, or if you are the student, come back to the college campus willing to take some risks to be in relationship with people. There's no other time in life that's going to be quite like this, where there are 1,200 people, similar age, similar values, living in such close proximity. It's a really a place to experiment with relationships, to understand yourself, to understand others, to enjoy, to have fun. So take risks. The other thing that I would say, it would be a really good time to really to like identify what's important in your life. And so if you're coming into Asbury new, or you're coming back to Asbury, your faith is important. Maybe academics are important, relationships, family is important. You name those things that make you tick, those things that are really important in your life, write them down. Those are your values. And what we see a lot in the counseling world is this disconnect. And what brings people in for counseling a lot is that their values, what's important to them, aren't being lived into. They're busy. But in our culture, we tend to get a little bit mindless and start running and responding. And we lose track of those things that actually are important to us. And that's a formula for sure for dissatisfaction in life. So let's just think about what those important things are, write them down. When you get back to campus, figure out, like, how am I living in to my faith, if that's what's important? How am I living into relationships, if those are important? In family, you may be away from family. How am I staying in touch with them? How are we communicating? And so really giving some time and attention to that would be helpful.
Or even as simple as don't neglect your hobbies. You know, don't neglect the things you do love.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Right.
Well, thank you again for your time. I really appreciate it. And we are so thankful for everything that you do here at Asbury.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of This is Asbury. To learn more about Asbury University, visit asbury.edu.